Good evening and welcome to the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first and third Fridays of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us on IRC on Freenode at #LinuxLugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@thelinuxlugcast.com. I'm sorry, feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mail list. Visit our website for the direct links. Tonight is show number 76. I'm your host, Father Finch, and I'm joined tonight by 5150. How are you, 50?
Oh, full barbecue, thanks.
And I believe Netminer is here as well, though he may be absent. Netminer, how are you?
Yeah, I'm here. I just have found the quote that I was looking for.
Excellent. So then I think we will kind of summarize what we were talking about. And it has to do with freedom and liberty. And Netminer is going to share a quote.
Yes, this is from Cauldron of Ghosts by David Weber and Eric Flint. It's a fictional book, but they talk about the three laws of thermosecurity. The first law is the desire of authorities to charge in charge of security for information will continue in a straight line with no limits in time and space, short of the heat death of the universe. The second law is the willingness of their authorities to supply them with the budget they need to do that is very definite limits, both in time and space. Hence the third law, which is the one we are operating under now. The information assembled by security authorities invariably overwhelms their ability to analyze the information. They are in effect suffocated by their own insecurity. The other party of their conversation here says, that's nonsense. What you're saying is security is impossible. Yes, but it is possible despite the natural integrations of security agencies. What it takes is agents who will know how to triage data and aren't afraid to do so. He says that they're pretty rare. So the fact the government wants all of your emails and all of your conversations and all of your phone calls is clearly well known to those who study the subject of government security versus privacy. The fact that they may have very little chance of actually doing anything positive with such information is also well known, but not as well advertised.
Very true.
During World War II, the British actually had one agent send the actual day of D-Day to the Germans. But of course, they had so much other disinformation going on that the real facts got lost in the shuffle. Churchill's The Truth Has to Be Guarded by a Bodyguard of Lies. Well, yeah, you know, that's what governments do, except they try to peel away any bodyguard of truth or lies that you put up. Rant mode off for the moment.
I think we all need a minute to digest. And I think, you know, without opening up a whole can of worms here and setting the example of a disinformation campaign where associates were putting out information contrary to where the actual D-Day invasion was going to take place, and then they threw the real location in there. The cynic in most of us would read that nothing can be believed if it's told to us by government.
Well, you have very few verifiable sources, especially with national security as the cover for any government questionable activities.
I suppose it's a matter of comfort levels.
Yes, if the government is comfortable, the average citizen should be less so, I think, and vice versa. If they're uncomfortable, you're doing it right.
Very true. Well, shall we move on to listener feedback?
Yes, let's.
All right, so we received kind of a broad community message, and this is from the Open Source Initiative. So there is an organization called Chick Tech, and I could be butchering that. It may be Chic Tech, but it seemed to be an organization focused on getting developing women in technology. So they are doing a couple of conferences throughout the country, and they have graciously reached out to offer the OSI exhibit space during the conferences. And there's 7 locations. They simply cannot attend them all. So they're looking for people in the OSI community to find folks local to each conference that would be willing to staff it for the OSI exhibit booth to raise awareness and adoption of open source software. So there's a whole list of different areas here, and I'll read through them quickly. And you can contact the OSI to tell them that you're available. So there's the Bay Area that's going on this weekend. So unless you're remarkably quick, that one may be gone. The New York area would be May 18th and 19th. Portland, June 15th through the 17th. Austin, Texas, August 4th through the 6th. Boston, Massachusetts, 25th and 26th. Seattle, Washington, the September 22nd and 23rd. And then Chicago, Illinois, October 19th and 20th. So I expect, Netminer, that you're going to be doing the Boston one for the OSI, correct? Okay. Next up is, there's been a lot of feedback in our community, our Google Plus community, which is good to see, because G Plus, you know, is always being put out there as a service that might be dying and that didn't live up to the expectation. But at least in our community, you know, we've got some solid contributors, and there's some good discussions. So I'm going to try and capture all the ones that have occurred since the last show. I may be remiss in mentioning those, because I'm not sure when the last show was.
Yeah, and there were so many topics. I just posted the link to the community. So if there's anything that you hear us talking about, because there are links and stuff in some of these posts, I think you can probably view the community without being having a Google account.
You know, that's a good question. We'll have to try that. Yeah, so in the few weeks since our last show, there's been a host of different conversations by different people. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. A lot of cool things to check out. Really, you gotta stop by and see how it's going. And I think that was all of the feedback we had. So I think we're going to start with show topics, and by way of alphabetical order, I'm up first. So I have a kind of, my couple of topics tie in together. It was a little hastily put together, so I apologize for not having more detailed notes. However, last weekend, there was a conference in my neck of the woods called CypherCon, and it's a hacker conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This was the second annual conference, and a friend contacted me approximately 3 weeks ago and said, "Hey, do you want to go?" And I said, "That looks awesome." Now, the unique thing about this conference is that the presentations, the conference kicked off at 5:30 in the afternoon, and it was a Thursday and Friday night, and then it went until approximately midnight, and it was at a museum in downtown Milwaukee. And the first night, my buddy and I went there, and you know, we got our badges, we got our swag, we walked around and we socialized. And the cool thing was that they had, you know, stuff that would be typical to a security conference. You had a lock picking village, you had a like an automobile hacking center, you had classic video game console hacking, you had like a maker village. There was a group there that was had set up the Internet of Things, kind of an Internet of Things to hack. So you're hacking cameras, you were hacking commodity routers, or you know, consumer routers and stuff. And there was a progression where you could just sit down at a desk, plug into a switch, and you had your own laptop, you had your own tools, you had internet access. So you did the research and you tried, you know, the person that got the farthest for that concert won a prize at the end. I didn't participate in that one, but I did see a lot of what was going on, just kind of shoulder surfing. It was pretty neat. They had two official tracks where they had national speakers there presenting on different security topics. And, you know, there was one of the keynote speakers was talking about engaging kids and getting them adjusted at a young age to, you know, embracing the hacker mentality, that, you know, we want to be curious, we want to explore, we want to take things apart to see how they work, we want to see if we can break things and then fix them again. And that was really inspiring, and that was one of the good presentations that I went to. There were a couple of other ones that were that really kind of opened your eyes, and you saw that people were passionate about what they were working on, and they had a level of passion that was really inspiring. There was a gentleman who, in his day job, kind of wrote the assessment reports from, I think it was penetration testing or vulnerability scams, but his passion was kind of exploring the RF spectrum, and his presentation was all about how he kind of took some Wi-Fi cameras that had a proprietary system where they would upload data to a cloud service, but he couldn't integrate that with his alarm system. So he had a physical alarm system that would throw off a klaxon and flash some lights when somebody was attempting to break in. He couldn't integrate his cameras, which were mouse and sensor activated, into his alarm system. So what he did is he started reading the spectrum, and what he realized is that outside of the that the 802.11, you know, the different spectrums there, you can actually capture the frames, but because you're not part of an authenticated session, you can't digest what's in those frames. But that doesn't prevent you from seeing the metadata that resides in those frames. So what he saw was that his cameras were sending out frames with a certain byte size, and once the motion sensor detected that there was movement, the camera would have to start uploading video. And once he started uploading video, or once the camera started uploading videos, those frame sizes started increasing because they were starting to pass actual data to the service. And so he set up a rule that when, you know, his monitoring system saw those frames from those particular MAC addresses jumping up in size, that it would set off the alarm. And that, I mean, that was just like a really cool presentation.
Outstanding. That's just a good way, a good example of somebody using their initiative to sort of hack the system that they've, you know, the people at Roadwood said, no, you shall not have access to this at that level. Eventually here in the House, I want something like that, that if there's camera picks up motion, alarms go off, and it sounds like World War III outside.
Yeah, and this is, this is something that he just had the cameras aligned around, and he had already built the alarm system and the monitoring system, and they were incompatible. So if you were to buy something that were was kind of all in one solution, it would work for you. But, you know, this is something that would give you a lot more features. And I'm trying to look to see, I know a lot of the presentations were videotaped and they were going to be posted somewhere. And I'll try to provide that link, because I mean, he came up with a couple of different ways that you could use this. You could tell if, you know, you could use this to monitor your house to see if somebody was home, because the MAC address on your cell phone for your Wi-Fi connection would all of a sudden pop online, and you'd see it if you had a device that was listening in that airspace. And once it saw it come online, you'd know, oh, hey, so-and-so's home. Or, you know, it was just really neat.
Well, and I think it may be changing, you know, but traditionally, home security systems, they may have plugins for expensive closed circuit video monitoring, but they don't want to talk to consumer level IP cameras.
Yep. And I think, again, this just feeds into that whole thing, is that we've got to get people curious. We've got to foster kind of a confidence in our youth, so that they don't think, oh, I have to buy into a solution and get myself locked in. It, you know, we want them to think, oh, hey, I'm thinking of something. How can I make that work?
And by the way, for some reason, my mumble dropped off without showing that I was dropped off when you were talking about the Kron system, and I thought you'd gone silent. So I thought, well, I'll take over the discussion for what reason, carry it. So I was talking to myself for about 3 minutes there before I realized nobody could hear me.
But at least you had the best audience.
Well, at least this audience won't complain.
Very true. So that was kind of the to-do for night one. And I went home and I had the next day off of work. And I thought, how can I be a part of this? And that kind of curiosity and that kind of that spark, that creativity led me to think, oh, I've got a Raspberry Pi here. Let me try something here. And so I don't know if we've talked about the Pirate Box in the past. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
Yeah, and actually dovetails into some of the discussion I'm going to have later.
Excellent. So to review, the Pirate Box is an autonomous system that in its base form you can plug in, and it presents an SSID that has no password. I think you can set a password, but a user can search for the SSID, connect to the Pirate Box, and then you get presented with a web browser. And depending on what access that the administrator allows, by its default setting, there's a web browser that allows you to enter kind of a chat, a web browser chat, so you could chat with other people, and your message has persistence as long as the system is running. There's another section that allows you to, it's more of a forum, so that you can upload forum posts, and that actually has persistence through a reboot. And then there's a file sharing application in there. And I don't know how sophisticated it is, and I apologize for not doing further investigation, but essentially, this you could throw this onto a Raspberry Pi, depending on what model. I did mine with a Pi 3 so that it was very easy because it already had the Wi-Fi built into it. But I thought to myself, I'm going to a hacker conference. You know, there's a lot of curious people out there. Let's see what happens. And so I threw a pirate box together. I threw some files on there saying, hey, just looking to see if anybody joins. I just wanted to see if anybody's poking around in the airspace because there was a wireless capture the flag going on all day. And I actually threw an episode or two of the Linux Lugcast, you know, just to promote the show a little bit. And then we got to the show. We arrived at the museum and I found a little spot hidden away and plugged it in and let it go all night. And, you know, while I was in a particular presentation hall, I was connected with my laptop, just monitoring it to see if anybody would join in and say anything. My buddy did just to test it. And I don't think anybody did. I'm going to go back. I haven't done so yet, but I'm going to go back and look through the logbook to see if there were any other connections to it, just to see if anybody was curious and then connected to it and then disconnected right away. I didn't see any, nobody uploaded any files, nobody made any new posts, but it was just so cool to put that out there and, you know, to think that I I started thinking about all the different uses that I could use for this. Like you could put this in a library or put it near a library. I was thinking about how much I miss living near the city because you could set this up and it's completely free and out there and people could just log on. And I think of it more of like the little library or the little lending library, you know, where you have an old mailbox where people can leave a book or take a book. I know that this was something that, along the lines of what Pegwall from the Linux Like Tech Show was looking at doing. So the rest of the conference went well. I mean, it was nice because I ran into some people. One gentleman I haven't seen in 20 years, you know, and it was really good to connect with him. There's another guy. It's been almost 10 years since we last hung out, so it was a really good small community. Everybody was friendly. Everybody was looking to help each other, you know, if they had questions, and a lot of good stuff going on.
Yeah, it sounds like a great system. The only question I have, and I don't want to be dog in the manger with this thing, but to secure, if you had files left, you'd have to watch them for viruses or nastiness. Now, if you could get your if you could do a read-only source, you could certainly expose some of the Gutenberg books or whatever for people to download, but you may want to make it a one-way system.
Yeah, there is that, but then you kind of lose out on something of it. Again, you know, somebody that's connected to something called the Pirate Box, they're already taking a risk. And if you, I don't know, I guess maybe it's just me. There was an author at the conference when I was there Thursday night and selling books, you know, and one of the books was a collection of short stories. And I'm like, oh, this seems really cool. I want to get this. And he didn't, he only took cash or PayPal, and I didn't have a PayPal account and I didn't have cash. And I said, are you going to be here tomorrow night? And he wasn't sure if he was going to be in town the next night. So what he did, he gave me his address and he said, you know, just send me a personal check. And the poignant thing he said to me was, if you can't trust somebody at a hacker conference, who can you trust? So that's kind of my feeling, is that we can only protect stuff I guess we can only, there's always going to be somebody that's going to take advantage of a system, regardless of what that system is. So we can only go so far in protecting it as to completely lock people out of the system. And if you put something like that out there, while you could make a section of it read-only. So you take like all the Gutenberg files that you put out there and you make those only read-only so that somebody couldn't alter them and pull them in, denying people the chance to share something, whether it's their own, you know, creative works, whether it's some thoughts and some opinions or some ideas, not allowing them to put that up there, even with the risk of that somebody's going to put something malicious up there, that just it doesn't sit well with me.
Well, at one time, there was a similar, very low-tech operation going on where people were cementing in various places USB sticks for basically blind data exchange. You take your laptop or whatever device and plug it in to the exposed connector and sample the content or exchange content or what have you. I'm just saying that to a certain degree, yes, you are trusting the public, and that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think if you look at in this particular scenario where I fired up this thing at a hacker conference where there are people, you know, there are people that are in the security community, people far more intelligent than I. They could have easily connected to this thing because it's essentially an open FTP server. They could have easily changed out the documents on the drive that I put on there with something malicious and probably just as easily gotten in and wiped the logs so that I would be none the wiser until somebody were to pull that down. But I think, at least I want to believe, and that doesn't necessarily make it the truth, that somebody wouldn't do that with the intent of hurting anybody. It's just, again, that curiosity they might be doing to find out where this file ended up.
Well, also, you're talking about a hacker conference, a moderate level conference. I have heard of the kind of very special preparations people do if they're going to a DEF CON, for instance.
Yeah, I think a black hat conference would be completely different. I would not walk around handing my Social Security card or credit card out around a black hat conference. And, well, a lot of people say those places are gray hat. You know, you don't even carry your smartphone. You just don't show up with any electronic devices at all, because there are people out there, if they can get in, especially if there's takes of no effort, then that's an invitation to do mischief.
Well, also it's like knowing your neighborhood. Some people will leave their car unlocked in their local neighborhood, but if they go downtown in parts of the city, and I'm saying $city, any city, they will know to double check their lock.
Well, I mean, even at a normal hacker conference, you guys have heard me tell the story a couple years ago at Ohio Linux Fest. It was, I don't know him, I met him, I don't know him really, what, you know, but one of the kids hanging out in the group essentially was carrying around a digital pineapple, and it was looking for access on smartphones, and if he could get access, he would set up a deal to Rickroll your phone, and he actually got Murph.
Right, but that's That's a trivial exploit, and it's something that can happen to you when you're out in public anywhere. So, does that mean you should turn off your cell phones anywhere?
It's also like war driving and leaving a message. By the way, you should really put a password on this system or something.
Exactly. There's a higher concentration of these people trying to gain access at a Linux Fest, at a hacker convention, at a technical convention, just because, they're already there doing that stuff, maybe for a capture the flag, maybe just to show off, or just because they're amongst their people. I don't think that the malice is really there in those events.
Yeah, it's sort of like you left your front door unlocked or something, or open.
Yep. So that's my review. So hopefully next year, same March time frame, CipherCon 3.0 will go on, and I'll be notified well ahead of time, and then I'll start, I guess, promoting it on the show. Because if there's anybody that listens, it would be cool to meet face to face at a con. Speaking of conferences, the next topic on the show is 5150 talking about where he's going to be around.
Yeah, I've registered for both PangoCon and Linux Fest Northwest in the past 24 hours, and I've gotten plane reservations and part of my hotel. I was hoping, well, no, I digress. First, we'll go into PangoCon. And I know regular listeners have heard me speak of PangoCon before, and it is probably, I would say, it's the most unique of Linux technical conferences because it is part technical conference, and the tech part is oriented towards open source. It's and sci-fi, like a sci-fi convention. Held simultaneously in the same place. And all you have to do is go to, this is programming on there, but if you look at the schedule, there are several tracks, and you could usually a way to subscribe on your phone to as many or as few tracks as possible. But it's broken down into, the tech track is pretty much monolithic, but then you have everything else, and the sci-fi, goes down to, there's a lot of on sci-fi literature, whether talks by noted sci-fi writers, how to write sci-fi. There's stuff on cosplay, how to do how to how to make a costume, basic sewing, things like that. Big food slash alcohol track. Tasting. I mean, I've had chocolate tasting with Eric Raymond. Last year, Tony Bemis and I both wound up at the History of Rum track, and then was it Dragon something hosted the podcast. Sorry guys for not remembering, but essentially, very knowledgeable on this is rum, this is how it came to be, this is how it was influenced by history and commerce, and then here's an example of seven or eight different types of rum. In fact, I picked from that I picked up a new brand. Oh, let's see. There's gaming, and the whole lobby is filled with like tabletop gaming sort of things. There is some video gaming, especially they usually bring in one of those. won't say Star Trek because that's trademarked, but you know, space opera bridge simulations where you come in and you have a bunch of networked PCs, and one of them's a commander station, one's communications, and one's weapons, etc. So there's that. There's usually a couple craft beer kegs open for those who are old enough to imbibe. Pretty much going 24/7, but most of the reasonable times during the day and evening. There is the liquid nitrogen ice cream lab, where on Friday and Saturday often includes ice cream infused with alcohol. They usually don't do that on, they still have ice cream on Sunday, but they drop the alcoholic part. You could probably arrange to go shooting with Eric Raymond, because I will guarantee that, but he usually comes, and one of his stipulations is sometime during the day he wants to go to a gun range, and he's really cool to hang out with, and always accessible and around. I mean, it wouldn't bother the man, but you'd certainly meet him. What else? Just look at the schedule and all the different tracks. There is just a smorgasbord of things. The nightlife. The sessions after 6 p.m. Any that are there, they tend to go in an adult. Well, not 10. They do go into an adult nature, so there is a complete adult track. And by adult, you know what I mean by adult. You understand? Not PG-13. More mature type topics. No, adult like that part of the internet we don't want to talk about. Adult. And then there's the room parties. There are a lot of organizations who, you know, if you have the ID card showing you're a member of the conference, they just throw alcohol-fueled parties there in the hotel. This is in Southfield, Michigan, in fact, just like the conference Father Finch talked about. I hope maybe if you're close enough, Father, maybe if you're not going to come to PenguinCon, maybe we can get together. But and the people you'll meet, you know, one of the things I go to these conferences for is to meet some of the other podcasters in FaceTime. Kevin O'Brien, Ahuka over on Hacker Public Radio, who I assume everybody's probably familiar with. He's real friendly. He's usually in charge of the tech track, so he doesn't, you know, he won't have time to really sit down usually and do a whole lot of talking, but certainly you can see him and say hello and introduce yourself. And then, of course, all the people from Sunday Morning Linux Review are regularly there. In fact, and do a live show on Sunday morning from PenguinCon. And if, you know, if for some strange reason you would like to, if you're going to PenguinCon and you'd like FaceTime with me and maybe get introduced to some of the other podcasters, I probably easiest way to get in touch with me is my email, which is still 5150@linuxbasement.com. And it's 5150 spelled out, FIFTONEFIFT at linuxbasement.com. So, and that this is for either conference we're going to talk about. So, do you guys have any questions on PegwaCon? I mean, I probably did it an injustice because there's just so much stuff there. Oh, and there's sort of this artist quality feel, and people are doing cosplay. And one of the rules is, you know, if somebody's dressed up in cosplay, don't just take their picture. You ask for permission first. And people are usually cool with that. And, well, the badges have a bunch of stickers, you know, three levels of stickers. Says, yeah, you know, go ahead and approach me and talk to me up to level. No, I don't want to talk to anybody. Go away. Some of the things came into play politically last year. The bathrooms are going to be gender non-specific. So if that bothers you, that might be a concern. In other words, you could walk in anyone, either one that you would like. let's see. And the whole artist colony thing, you know, sort of artist colony type feel. There are vendors there doing a bunch of handcrafted and otherwise art type stuff or t-shirts or whatever. So, and don't be surprised if you see somebody out there in the lobby getting body painted. So it's definitely PG-13 rated conference, maybe. You probably would not want to bring your small children around because there might be things there that you would have to explain to them. But otherwise, it's just great. And I mean, it's a blast. It's like, it is, I think, like no other conference you can attend.
Yeah, I remember describing that conference to somebody, telling them exactly what it was and how it seemed like it would be the ultimate conference to attend.
And it's the last, this year it's the last weekend of this month.
Yeah, and unfortunately I'm not going to be able to make it. I want to say that the area in Michigan where it is about 6 hours away from me. Probably more, because I'm bad at mapping.
All right, well, there are, you know, a lot of podcasters in that general, well, I won't say general area, but certainly driving distance. And always say they're going to come. And I certainly encourage them to do so at least 1 year. And I think they'll be hooked. Okay, the next weekend after that, and the last couple of years, Linux Fest Northwest and PegwaCon have been on different weekends. And I don't know if that's something they finally figured out and did on purpose, or it's a happy circumstance, because for years and years and years they were on the same weekend and you would be forced to pick one or the other. And Linux Fest Northwest is unfortunately I wanted to get reservations in the hotel where it's hosted in Southfield, Michigan. And it looks, when I waited too long, it looks like all the blocks of rooms are accounted for. Shouldn't be a problem now to still get reservations in adjacent, though not as fancy, hotels down there in that area. I mean, it's just nice with the room parties or whatever. And if you tend to indulge, an elevator ride is a lot easier than walking a couple blocks down the street. The last year, I was going, had to go across a highway, which is actually 8 miles of rap fame. You know, going, you know, small walk area, you know, cross an overpass to my hotel. And I think definitely this year I want to pick one that is not where I have to cross that. Not that it was a terrible hardship, but, you know, might be prudent to just be crossing regular streets on the way home. So, guess that's okay. That's enough for Ping Pong. On to Linux Fest Northwest. That is held at a technical in Bellingham, Washington. And it'll be the next weekend after PenguinCon. Very much a more traditional conference, certainly a more local feel than, say, Ohio Linux Fest. More homey, I guess you would say. You can go to the student union and eat. Though I have to say, I would probably recommend, especially this, you know, Bellingham is a great tourist destination for craft beer enthusiasts. There are a lot of hops grown up in that area, and so definitely I would probably at the noon hour get an Uber or something down to one of the many beer pubs downtown. And in fact, if anybody's up for playing a little hooky and doing something of a pub crawl, I might, you know, contact me. That might be something that we could arrange. And again, the people I am going to meet there, Door-to-Door Geek and his posse. I met Cody Cooper and Eric last year and other people that have escaped me. Probably go back to my review last year. It'll have a list of everybody that I met. And, you know, you also see Door at Ohio Linux Fest usually, and in that case be Stormwatch and Tracy. I met him, you know, along other many other members of the Podnuts posse. So yeah, but a lot of good information there. I'd kind of hope missing out on some of the good talks for visiting some of the pubs, but yeah, perhaps one could twist my arm. The after party, usually the after party, the beer was brought in by some colleges, their home brewing organization. They would bring in beer. Last year they actually had it catered by one of the local brew pubs. So it was a weird situation. You know, you could get good beer for free on tap, and then you would see people paying for Budweiser. Some people should just be slapped. I'm sorry. But, you know, if you're a fan of beer, and that's a completely side thing. And I guess I didn't get to see it last year yet. I guess the college has a renowned electronics museum. So if you're a ham guy or just a general electronics hacker, that is definitely worth checking out. And it's open to attendees usually during that weekend. But very well presented conference. The main trouble is you just can't get there from here. And where Bellingham is, if you took 10 steps to the west, your feet would be in the Atlantic Ocean. If you took 10 steps to the north, you would be a Canadian. So that gives you an idea. They do have an airport up there, but unless you're very lucky, well, I found out, I could fly at last year. I really didn't have any good options for flying directly to Bellingham. There was like flying to Seattle and literally a 7-hour layover to fly on to Bellingham. So I just flew into Seattle and rented a car for the final about 90-minute leg of tour. Maybe more than that, because really if you're getting there to get there Friday evening, there's going to be rush hour traffic. So it's not going to be as fast as Google tells you it's going to be to transverse the mileage. Beautiful, incredibly beautiful drive, though, because you're driving right along the edge of the ocean. Though you don't, if you look out there, you're not really going to see open ocean because that area has a bunch of buffer islands and peninsulas and stuff that stick out. So it's really looking across a lake, and then you have these tree-covered, beautiful island-type things on the other side. But it's incredibly beautiful drive on between Seattle and Bellingham. So it's worth it just for that. But, yeah, it's the flight out real-time, the one I picked is 5 hours to Seattle. And 7 hours back, it looks worse than that, but I pick up 2 hours coming back. It's probably, sounds like talking to other people, it is difficult to get there, but it's probably worse from the Midwest, where I'm coming from. And I could have flown into Bellingham at a reasonable time on Friday night. Trouble is, they're just, apparently their airport must close on Sunday at 5 o'clock, and the talks go to 5 o'clock, so unless you're willing, you know, to miss the last couple hours of talks, probably your only option is to fly in Seattle and then flying out from Seattle looked like, you know, all the trips coming my way were, you know, they didn't leave till 11 o'clock, which, or nearly midnight, which really, that's not bad. I don't mind an evening in Seattle, taking, you know, find a good restaurant, take that in. I was thinking this morning, oh, well, I should rejigger my flight since I can do that in 24 hours and take a flight in going into Bellingham and then, you know, just take an Uber back. And probably, you know, because a lot of the places you're going to go during there, you obviously drive, if you imbibe driving is contraindicated, you know, you'd be taking an Uber anyway. But then I thought, yeah, well, if I'm coming back, then I'm gonna have to like Uber from a restaurant to the, I'll just rent a car, but you know, to have it both ways and have it there. That's what I did last year. So yeah, the hassle of the transportation may be the one big impediment, but I think it's worth it. I mean, it's just a great destination to go to, even if there wasn't a fest. On hotels, literally, there's nothing in walking distance from the venue. So I did. Last year, had nice, fortuitously, I right next to hotels, right next to a brew pub and quote casino. So me and Dor hung out there some. And, but this year I just took the Hampton Inn, the default. That's probably farther away than I was from the venue last year, but we'll try that and see what's new there. Probably a better hotel than what I had, but maybe less convenient for transportation. Now, Dore and the crew, usually they fly into Portland and rent a van, and you know, there's enough of them, they rent a big van and come up. And I know Netminder suggested last year, well, why don't you look at other options? I found Dore is coming to Portland. I looked going to Portland. I looked at, you know, Netminder said, you know, come south from Canada, maybe. No, my best option is Seattle, as bad as that is. So, but yeah, definitely fun, interesting people to meet. Great information. And listen, if you're a fan of craft beer, I don't know if there's certainly probably no better destination to wind up in.
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
How do you get to the Atlantic Ocean from Washington State?
Did I say Atlantic? I'm Pacific, obviously.
It would have made it easier for me to get there. I'm in the Boston area.
Of course, you never know how much time I spend at the brew pub. I may wind up in the Atlantic.
Just depends on who you get frisky with. No, that is one conference I hope to attend, you know, someday. I've got a dear pair of friends that live, I think, only a couple of miles away from the university, and I would certainly love to impose upon them me staying with them, but just the time away from the family as well as the expense of the round trip flight kind of makes that a pipe dream right now.
Well, certainly love to see you there sometimes. Probably the three, but the one you mentioned, I'd like to see that sometime. I've worked out, I can probably afford three little trips like this a year, the other one being Ohio Linux Fest. So, but there are other and a lot of them, I think Texas and Southeast Linux Fest, they're just impossible for me to get to because of the time of year. I've kind of settled on those three. And, of course, Kansas Linux Fest, which is no hardship to get to. As my go-to conferences. But, you know, I hate to get into a rut. I would invite the listeners, if you have a Linux or technical conference or, you know, sci-fi conference, anything you think might be interesting to the people who listen to the show that might be unbeknownst to them, you know, please send us some feedback on what your favorite conference is that you would like us to head to.
I got an even better idea. Why don't you come on the show and we'll all talk about your favorite conferences?
Oh, very much a better idea. And if you have a conference you'd like to promote, you know, definitely you're always welcome.
Absolutely. So are we ready to dip our toes into paranoia?
Yeah, I have sort of a tinfoil hat topic. We discussed this, whether it would be appropriate for the show. And I know there are some people who complain in the past when we depart from, you know, strict Linux tech type information. But really, I think this is something that is relevant to anybody, you know, who is interested in tech and communications. And this probably isn't the one you're going to think of. There's been a lot of talk on podcasts about this bill that has gone through Congress. I don't know if it's been signed yet. That essentially authorizes ISPs to sell whatever browsing information that they can glean from your connection to whoever wants to pay for it. And I think that's definitely relevant too, but it's going to be discussed on other podcasts. I don't know if this is. This is something that came up after the London Parliament terrorist attack. And, you know, complete tragedy there. And nobody disagrees on that. But apparently, right before the attacker committed this crime, alleged attacker, I guess I would say, I don't think there's much dispute at the point, but he used a WhatsApp account on his phone to send a message to somebody, and the British government, their security services, are all up in arms that they cannot read the contents of whatever that message was because WhatsApp incorporates end-to-end encryption. Now, I would think probably they, articles I've seen implied they don't even know who it was sent to. I can't imagine that. But, you know, the security services went to WhatsApp and said, yeah, we didn't need to know the contents of this message. They said, you know, sorry, it's end-to-end encrypted. We couldn't give you that information if we wanted to. We don't have that. It's encrypted by the clients on both ends. And, of course, this started hysteria in the British government, and the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, said, quote, you know, end-to-end encryption on messages is completely unacceptable. When looking up the link for this article that I use, and this is from Reuters, I didn't drill down to the article, but saw an article headline that 10 Downing Street repeats what she said. So Prime Minister's on board, and this looks like it could, you know, Britain is definitely a more of an anti-privacy government, even more than ours is, I would say. But, you know, given the current administration, which, full disclosure, I certainly didn't vote the other way. But, you know, you never get the candidate that agrees with everything you do. And I think this is generational as well. These people don't use technology, didn't grow up with technology, don't understand technology, are much more likely to come down on the side of surveillance rather than the side of privacy. But just these people don't understand that, you know, this very occasional, perhaps, being able to come up with some little bit of information after the fact, that you know, the ability to do that is far outweighed by the right of people to have privacy. I mean, no other form of communication would they be able to intercept that communication, the contents of that communication, without a warrant. I mean, I don't think you get a warrant that says you can open somebody's mail. Definitely they could, you know, snail mail, printed mail with a stamp, you know what I mean. Definitely they could find, if they knew who the receiver was, they could go to them and say, yeah, we're just going to subpoena that letter. But I don't even think there's anything that, not to say they don't do it. This is something Bruce Schneier said at PingCon a couple of years ago. You know, we can't rely on laws. If we had privacy laws that said the government can't look at our communications, it doesn't make any difference because you can't you can't trust the government not to break their own laws. You know, you've actually have to take technological steps to control your own privacy. That's a digression, but I mean, given the nature of the current administration, unless it's their communications that are being looked at, you know, I think definitely would come down. I mean, if somebody's looking at their communications, and you know, definitely there's an example of them being incensed about somebody might be spying on their communications. But come down to us, our communications, oh, that's a whole different thing. We have, you know, we've got no right to privacy. But I said I don't think you could legally steam someone's mail open in transit. And they say, and I'm a skeptic on this, they say, okay, yeah, the NSA database, it shows who you're calling, but no, we're not recording the contents of every phone call. I put my tinfoil hat very tightly on here. That's an awful big data center down in Utah if you're not recording that kind of data, I think. I'd like to see some statistics on that. What would it take if they were recording every phone call? Would that exceed their capacity? I haven't seen the stats on that yet. I would think, you know, since they're, like everything in the Library of Congress, you could probably put that on a thumb drive. You know, if all they were doing is just recording, you know, X called Y at this time, I wouldn't think that would take up a whole bunch of data by comparison. To actually storing the binary of the contents of the phone call. Okay, I'll loosen my tinfoil hat just a little bit here. But, yeah, it's just perception. I mean, folks like us look at this and say, I mean, are you kidding me? You're telling me I have no right to privacy without a government back door. And of course, it's not just the fact that the government can get in. If you build a backdoor into encryption, then that's a vulnerability that will be targeted by hackers and exploited. And since it's hard, you know, hardwired into the code, once that vulnerability has been discovered and published, then, you know, you have no encryption anymore. So it's not just governments listening to you. It's if anybody has enough resources can be listening in. And you know, we have the whole Nazi era Goebbels quote. I think it usually attributed to Goebbels that, you know, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to fear. Well, you know, you do have, there are business reasons to encrypt communication. Otherwise, you'd have to physically transfer data by hand. If you had sensitive trade secrets, you would want to have those broadcast in the clear. So, and you know, look, if there was an encrypted form of Mumble, if there's an encrypted form on a form of IRC, I would be migrating to that in an instant, as long as everybody else, you know, was doing it. And of course, encryption between multiple people is difficult because you'd have to encrypt separately for each and every recipient for it to be effective. If everybody's using the same encryption key, then again, it's eventually discoverable, and then you have no encryption.
For historical note, the Enigma machine, which was the most general German military cipher machine of World War II, started out as an encryption machine for business communications. The early versions were done for business purposes, not for military purposes.
Right. I mean, the difference between the business available Enigma machine and the military grade one was, I think, a third cipher wheel or something like that. So, and that the business level one was susceptible to brute force hacking, and of course it took Turing and his computer to crack the military grade one. And it's interesting, if you've seen the Imitation Game, and I'm surprised I had never seen this before. They were still, even, you know, they were throwing this computing power at it, not having any success. And then finally, somebody mentioned that since it was German communications, every message included Heil Hitler. And they also had, you know, I think they also had a preamble sort of thing that was the same. And once they figured that out, that's how they started cracking messages, because they knew that exact pattern would be in every message. So, I mean, if the Germans had not been, such political fanatics, that the cipher might never have been broken during the war.
Well, actually, the first cracking of Enigma was done with relay machines. What we would call a relay computer using relay logic. The other machine, Colossus, was used to crack headquarters teletype ciphers. The Enigma was basically a Morse code encoding system used by lower level units. The first true computer was used to crack the higher level headquarters to headquarters traffic.
I mean, if this kind of movement takes off in Britain and the United States, assisting on a back door, then would it come down to laws that says you couldn't write your own, if all of us decided, we want to send each other encrypted emails, of course, we could all use PGP. Would they say, nope, PGP is now illegal? And then if we were to write our own software for encryption, would they make that illegal? If they're enforcing it, are we back to software verification, which would be the end of all open source and home written software, because everything would have to be authenticated against a list of authorized software. I doubt if we would ever get quite that far, but definitely, one of the things that's been talked about with security, for this to get in use in general public, the end-to-end encryption is just going to have to, you're going to have to use a system that seamlessly does end-to-end encryption automatically, because most people are not going to go through the hassle of installing PGP and, printing out their message in text and converting that and adding it as an attachment, which is essentially what you do with PGP. So, I haven't seen any really further stories on this since the beginning, but since it's the British government, I wouldn't be surprised to see somebody working on the background in legislation. And if they did, this is something, since the administration is focused on anti-terrorism, is this something they're going to look at and say, oh, great, we need to copy this? So it's definitely something we need to be aware of and keep monitoring.
Yeah, well, I know that that part of the reason my encryption in a lot of countries Red China for one, and probably the Soviet Union, by private citizen is frowned on heavily. I also know that somebody wrote a Pascal program that was able to send encrypted messages as a description of a baseball game.
Well, right. There are countries where an unmodified BlackBerry phone is not legal.
Well, it's funny that this topic was on the show notes tonight, because Jay Rulo and the IRC shared a project that Matt Hartley of a couple different podcast fame was talking about, and it's called Needle. And what the project is aiming to do is to create an application that generates random, yet I'm trying to think of the word here. What it does is it generates internet traffic based on an algorithm, and it's all random traffic, but it's legitimate traffic. So it does, let's see, what is it doing right now? Currently, it does random search strings for Google. So it connects to Google, does a search, and then clicks on the results. It visits Alexa's website for the top million list. The program generates English names, popular English names, and then visits their profiles on Twitter, and then does random searches on Twitter for topics, and then it does random DNS queries. And right now they're trying to integrate this into WhatsApp, Spotify, and Messenger. So why this is good, especially what you're talking about with encryptions, so if you're doing they're looking to ban encryption, and then you stack it on top of they're now permitting ISPs to sell your data, is that all of this traffic would be generated from one source, and the whole idea is trying to find that needle in the haystack would be near impossible. So if you put this on top of your VPN tunnel or your Tor browsing habits, and you throw it on a Raspberry Pi somewhere on your network, it's going to generate so much traffic. It's going to create so much noise that, you know, it's kind of the obfuscation piece where your legitimate traffic will be included in that noise, and they'll have to gather everything and try to cipher, or not cipher, but try to figure out what's the legitimate you, and it's going to be near impossible. So if you're doing that with encryption, that's the same thing, you know, where if we even encrypt our emails to people who, it's just like, hey, buddy, how's it going? Haven't seen you in a while. You want to go fishing? You know, the more we encrypt that stuff, the more noise we generate. Well, this exponentially generates more noise.
Yes, computer-generated noise to counter computer-generated surveillance.
Yeah, right, but, hopefully you've got a huge amount of bandwidth that you never touch if you're going to do this, because, you know, even if 1 out of 10 of the things that you browse is legitimate, that's enough to be searchable, and they can probably build a profile on you and figure out, I mean, you know, that I'm not going to search a whole bunch of Microsoft. Well, as a tech, I probably do search a bunch of Microsoft's sites, but I'm probably not going to search a whole bunch on fashion or something like that. So that, you know, if one out of 10 of my browser hits was legitimate, and somebody was actually looking into me, they could probably sift out. So then what do? One out of 100, one out of 1,000. At what point does this so negatively affect your bandwidth that it's not worth it? You know, but definitely thanks, Jay Rulo, for posting that. It's something I'll definitely save the link on and take a look at. Another thing, and I'll volunteer for this. I'm not going to say it's going to be next week, next month, whatever. But eventually, you know, since I'm planning to do some VPN for, you know, remote connection to my system anyway, probably will not get my travel router done by the end of the month. But, you know, maybe by next August for Ohio Linux Fest. Shoot for that. But I digress. You know, we've seen several articles since this ISP being able to sell your data has come out. Oh, just run a VPN and they won't be able to tell what you're doing. And then I've seen several articles, no, VPN's not going to do you any good. So I will look into that and see if I can find the best opinions on that on the web. And again, if there's any listener who knows the truth of this, please feel free to either explain it to us in feedback or preferably come on a show and explain it to us.
Well, do you want my...
I have a quick one, but...
Go ahead, Netminer.
Well, as someone who's looked at a VPN service called Private Internet Access... the whole idea is that you can secure your traffic, especially over local connections, be they hardwired or Wi-Fi or what have you. And it's all dumped into the private internet accesses servers, and your traffic becomes part of the river that's coming out of the VPN provider's system, who has a big backbone trunk.
Oh, it just occurred to me one thing we could fight this on. What about HTTPS? Let's say there was a HTTPS website out there with a forum for terrorists or whatever. So, you know, would you be able to take talk to this, Home Secretary Amber Rudd and said, yeah, are you going to be so outraged about encryption when it gets applied to your credit card transactions?
Yeah, so you're going to shut down online banking because a terrorist might use it.
Because I guarantee you, I mean, it's not like HTTPS is as secure as other forms of encryption, but I guarantee you, if you put a government backdoor into it, that would be out there on the internet within 90 days. Of course, someone will probably write in and say, no, there is a backdoor.
I just lost audio. Is anyone talking?
Well, I can hear you.
Okay, just things just dropped silent so quick I didn't know whether I was still connected. I do have, before the end of the show, I have a problem maybe you guys can help me with.
Sure, and just to make sure, Father Fitch, you're still hearing us?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, please go ahead, Netminer. We'll see what we can do.
I need a program that I can run in the background that would alert me if my internet connection goes down. Sometimes my browsers don't get the message too quick and I need to reboot my router. I know you can do it manually with a ping, like ping for Google or what have you, but I wondered if there's anything that does that can put a heartbeat out there, and if it doesn't get the proper response, it will say, wait a minute, boss, your internet's down.
I wonder if there would be anything like that built into DDWRT, because if it did it automatically, that would probably be the best solution. And you know, this happens to me, that my uplink will either really slow down or completely break at least every once every 48 hours. And all of a sudden I'll be streaming video and it'll go offline. And sometimes I'll just be able to restart it. Then I'll have to go open a terminal and do a ping and yep, I'm offline, and have to go in and do a power toggle on the uplink. So let's see if there's maybe something in pfSense, because that would really be helpful to me. You know, but yeah, you would think there would be something based on ping, you know, that would throw you. But I mean, whether it would do just something about throwing a flag into the command line or set off buzzers or whatever or something, you'd think somebody had written a program like that.
Yeah, just that occasionally I have to reset my pfSense box because something's having indigestion in downstream.
But usually it's me, it's the uplink radio. Very rarely, you know, I reset that, still don't get back, and then have to bring pfSense down and reboot. And of course, I not only shut down the pfSense box, but toggle the power on the switches as well, and then that'll come back. And then if doing those two things don't fix it, my next step is to call the ISP, and I'll usually say, yeah, we're down.
Well, my one thing that could be causing a problem is that my modem is remote from the pfSense box. That is to say, my DSL modem is remote from the pfSense box, and it's run over a long wire. And the modem is powered, in an older part of the house. So I may be able to reduce some of the problems by having my modem and DSL and pfSense box together, so I can power them and perhaps power condition together instead of having the modem where it can fail silently.
Well, mine, I'm pretty sure it's 100% the fault of the ISP when it does that.
Well, Verizon DSL on old phone lines, it's hard to tell where the failure point is.
I'll see if I can't find something. You'd think if you'd maybe search on ping, an alarm or something like that, it might yield results.
Well, I figured that this group and our comrades could come up with something. I mean, I could do a Python something or other, but I don't know how to do the desktop notifications. You know, have a small file of sites to ping just so you don't get a single point of failure, and say, if you can't reach these sites, the network is definitely down. You know, if you can't reach Google, if you can't reach YouTube or what have you, the network is liable to be down. And pinging every, you know, minute or two would probably be enough.
And like I said, probably somebody's written just such a plugin for pfSense. So if anybody out there knows of such a thing, I mean, if it's not built into pfSense, pfSense is certainly customizable. Or if somebody gives a leg up on how to write such a thing. Because that, you know, that'd be, you know, you could do it without your interaction. Of course, you know, periodically your internet would inexplicably go down while your PSX sense box was rebooting. But of course, it's going down anyway for you.
So,
well, if what I'm seeing out at the PF sense box, I haven't looked at the logs. It's probably a bad idea. But the box itself seems to be working perfectly fine. It just there we lose connectivity at, you know, server dot, you know, youtube.com is no longer reachable, or whatever, you know, Google is not reachable.
Yeah, usually when I have it go down, I look at the box, you know, the WAN link address is blank. Sometimes it's just that it's connected, but the DNS isn't working.
That's what I basically happen, and then I have to manually switch the router. Although what I will end up doing probably is running a specially colored phone line from my location. I originally had my computers all in a bedroom in a different part of the house. So that's where the modem is. Now I'll just run a phone line with a special color that is unfiltered to the modem and have it all in the same area so I can manage even back up the whole lot.
Of course, it's pretty telltale for me when I come in the room or in the house and all the TVs with Chromecast say, yeah, connected to your network, but not connected to the internet on the blue and white screen. Though that not necessarily because sometimes you can be streaming. If it's a DNS problem, you can be streaming and it's got the, you know, it's got the address, so it's not querying DNS. So you come over and the browser won't work, but you know, you're still streaming from Hulu or something. I have had that happen.
Yeah, I've had one browser work and one that's more DNS verifiable or what have you, it doesn't. Or if I'm trying to open a new page.
Well, I have a couple of quick thoughts here, and then we should probably be wrapping up the show because we're approaching the 2-hour mark.
Right, and it didn't help that we started an hour late in the first place. Sorry, guys.
Oh, it's nobody's fault. It's par for the course. But depending on how frequent, and this isn't going to affect you as much, 5150, but Netminer, it may be impacting you, is that what large regional ISPs will do is shift around IP space to accommodate customers. And so what happens is that your router or your DSL modem will sometimes have an IP address. And when they move those networks around, they're depending on you, your device, to solicit another DHCP request so that it gets an address with the provider. And until you reboot that modem, it's not doing that. So that could be why it's happening. And in that case, you're not going to know that the internet's down from a module that's a plugin on PFSense, because PFSense is going to rely on some sort of relay, unless you're taking care of your own internal mail relay to notify you. It won't be able to reach the internet either to notify you. So just a search that I was doing here is, of course, presuming that all of your boxes are now Linux. There's a bunch of different, you know, stuff out there where people are using scripts to just, like you said, ping random devices and get a report. The alerting problem or the alerting portion is something that would be unique, but depending on what you're running, given your skill set, I think you'd be able to, you know, kick off a cron job that does a repeat count for pinging you know, a list of hosts, and depending on what your returns are, it would send a notification to the desktop, but that it's that notification piece that I can't see right here.
Well, I've often thought about having an internal mail server, not for email, but for just notification stuff and debugging stuff and stuff like that, so I can have my local systems basically send something that's designed to be a log or a flag within the in-house network, nothing that's designed to go out on the world.
Okay, then maybe there's a mechanism that already exists in your computer. And again, this is all observational and anecdotal. But I know that most people who have pseudo accounts, you have a mail spool on your machine. So if you created a condition where you were pinging something and it would say, oh, something's not good here, send this mail locally, and you had a client that was running our, you get a mail notification saying, hey, the internet's down.
Now, with that moving ISP blocks around, when I reset my router, it would ask for a new lease, and that would tell my modem to kick the ISP, right?
Yeah, and again, my knowledge of DSL is way old, so I don't know if that's exactly the case. I'm doing this more based on cable modem service. So, for instance, my modem, which is a cable modem, gets an IP address, which is a DHCP address on a certain particular pool for my neighborhood node. Once my modem has that address, it's going to retain that address, and it goes from a broadcast to find a new address to unicast. So unless my ISP prevents hosts from my local network reaching out to that device, it's not going to give up that network or that address necessarily right away. So rebooting the modem effectively causes it to go out and do a DHCP broadcast again, where it's going to find the local DHCP server or the DHCP relay until, you know, the next time that comes.
Well, so what I'm saying is, by rebooting the router as it comes up, it says, give me an address, please. And then the modem goes out to the ISP and says, hey, I just got a new connection here. Could you give me a new address? I'm just saying, I'm seeing a waterfall effect where rebooting the router is actually telling the router to ask for a new lease.
Yes. That's the situation I'm describing, is because your modem is now in a different, if they're shifting IP blocks around, your modem sitting on a segment that doesn't exist anymore. So for the duration of the lease, it's going to attempt to reach the old DHCP server through unicast. And then once the lease expires, that's when it's going to send out that broadcast. So depending on the lease interval for those IP addresses, it may just sit there kind of recycling. So if you were to leave it for a day or two days, it would eventually get a new address just because that lease would time out. And by rebooting the modem, you're forcing that lease to time out, because when the device comes up, it doesn't have that in its system.
I don't know whether it's a power problem. Also, if I gather up my networking stuff to one location, I can at least think about putting a UPS just on that segment.
Absolutely. I did that about 2 months ago, where I put my PFSense box and my cable modem on a UPS, so that regardless of the power status of the house, I still have The two things that take the longest to boot up after a power outage, they're still online.
Well, also, quite frankly, because of the spring, and I have things like a furnace and sump pumps and stuff like that that could be causing a power surge in the system. So it could be a power quality problem. I'm just saying that concentrating everything together and then giving them some kind of private protection could kill a lot of birds.
You got it.
Or swat a lot of bugs, especially if I put my, I could easily put my, one of my laptops on a direct connection to pfSense that doesn't go through the switches, or even have the switches also on this, at least the head switch on this UPS.
Yeah, depending on how you have everything wired and what the capacity of the UPS you have is, it certainly stands to benefit you if you take all of your network equipment and put it on a UPS, because then during power events, whether it's just a brownout or a blackout or just a temporary spike, you're conditioning that power so it's steady to those devices, and that power is not the issue when you have an outage. And once the devices that you're working with come back online, they have ready access.
Also, I bet you, if you get anything except the very dumbest UPS, I could connect that up to my pfSense box and it could say, power going down.
Yeah, you could.
And yeah, one thing, if it's a momentary glitch causing something, a consumer level UPS may not help you at all, because, you know, like a server level at UPS, you're always running off the battery, and then the battery is being charged. The ones you buy any retail computer store, or usually online or whatever, it's just you're on live power all the time, and if that power goes down, it's supposed to snap and switch you to the battery. But if that's not fast enough for your mode, probably would be. But, you know, you know, if you've got a power interruption, it might not switch fast enough to keep the connection up.
Well, I suspect some combination of UPS and even a dumb power conditioner, transformer-based power conditioner. We're not talking large amounts of power here. We're just looking for something that will step on spikes and glitches.
Yeah, see, that's what I have, is line conditioners rather than UPSs. Well, it hadn't been there for years, but 10, 15 years ago, I was actually able to see brownouts on the system.
Well, I'm just thinking of maybe I'll go to line conditioning, especially since, like you say, some of my stuff, if not connected directly to the heavy equipment, is certainly exposed to its electrical noise. You know, it may not be on the same circuit, but it's not shielded cable of any kind. So if there's any noise in the neighborhood, it'll pick it up. Yep, looks like another trip to Micro Center. My home away from home. And thank you, gentlemen. Perhaps we can address this problem next week. Next show.
Yeah, we'll put it out there for everybody.
And one thing I want to mention in passing before we end. Still dealing with the broken headset, with the one can swinging loose and headband cutting into my head because of it. So I've been procrastinating, and I thought last night, yeah, I really need to try that homemade Suguru thing, see if it, because I'm going to need the headphones tomorrow night. So, and that minor, I'm glad of your concerns last time, but this is external weather stripping silicone that I got, so it should not have the mold and bug pesticides that you mentioned. But I open up an instructables page for how to make the stuff. Just did a Google search and on homemade Suguru and cornstarch and silicone, and came off the instructables page, and it said, this only works with your older silicone. It will not work with new silicone like GE Silicone 2. Guess what tube of silicone I'm holding in my hand here that I bought weeks ago? I was in town. Well, I wouldn't have had time to do it. I was in town today, and I completely forgot about getting it. So I'll put it on the shopping list. But apparently to do this, the silicone in the squeeze tube is not what you want. You're looking for the silicone in the barrel, you know, that you put in the thing that you... You know, in the caulking gun, and go click, click, click. At least that's the impression the instructables article gave me. So, still got a broken headset. Try to get that done in 2 weeks.
Well, broken headset's better than a broken head, and we're just glad that you're okay and that you're taking care.
Well, thanks, Nat Miner. I appreciate that.
Likewise, and with that, we're going to say good evening for tonight. Our next recording date is April the 21st of 2017. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. Thanks to Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting, WordPress support, and email list server. Thanks to Delwyn for providing the Mumble server we use and creating a bot module to find the next show recording date. Type .ns in the IRC command line. I have been Father Finch, and I was joined tonight by 5150.
So long, folks.
And the irreverent Net Miner.
Thank you, folks. Hope you have a nice night. And those of you who are having religious holidays during this period, I hope you have a fine holiday season.
Thank you, and don't forget to join us in 2 weeks. Likewise, I didn't realize the stream wasn't going until nobody was talking, and the voxing woke me up as well. I've had such a long absence from the show because I was getting tired of all the groupies. Mother Finch was having some issues with all the photographs that were being requested of us when we'd go out to dinner or to the grocery store. So are you ready to burn the midnight oil, 50, now that you're all rested up?
I guess so. Are we anticipating a long show?
No, not at all. But we just have to kill time until Honky can get home.
Okay, that's fine. I was just, I was going to look for the show notes. I really haven't done any projects. I was going to make a point of getting up and actually working on something so I could have something to talk about. I have registered for PenguinCon and Linux Fest Northeast, so I thought I would talk about those shows a little bit.
Sure, and I've got a couple of things that I've done in the recent past that might be of interest. I don't have any formal notes, but I'm sure I can add some by tomorrow.
And not strictly Linux, so maybe we can discuss before the show if we think it's appropriate. I think it's an appropriate topic because it does deal with, don't say software freedom, software liberty, because this would apply equally to proprietary, non-proprietary software. Now, and it's probably been discussed on other shows, Congress with the whole letting your ISP sell your information to everybody. But just as important or more important, after the terrorist incident in London a couple weeks ago, and I'll have to look up a link, the British Home Secretary came on the next day, apparently right before executing the attack. The attacker sent a message on a internet surface that uses end-to-end encryption, and when they went to the company, you know, the company says, you know, we couldn't tell you what the message contents of the message were if we wanted to. It was encrypted on the client end and decrypted on the client end. And the British Home Secretary says, oh, how dare anyone make software that doesn't have a security back door for the government to get in.
Yeah, I mean, shouldn't that just give the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Homeland your passwords to everything, and that's not a problem.
Right, and everyone should ship keys to their local police station just in case they need to come in.
Bingo bango.
Who needs privacy anyway if you're not the government?
Let's not forget that the Internet of Things is starting to make that a reality.
Well, I mean, current administration has, I think, here has no better understanding of privacy. So, yeah, I could certainly see some sort of law getting passed as there shall be no encryption software without a back door.
Right, which is fundamentally flawed in that you don't have encryption if there is a back door.
Yeah, wasn't there a chip of that name?
Wait, are you talking about like an EPM module?
No, I'm talking about the, what was it, Clinton era, we will allow you to encrypt everything as long as you give us a key to, you use the government-approved hardware encryption. With a government-approved key that we will keep separate in two pieces with two government agencies, and since it's two government agencies, nobody will ever talk to each other, so your key will be perfectly safe. Read my lips. Your privacy is safe in our hands. Clipper chip, anyone?
Oh, that's it. You're dating yourself a bit, though.
I'm an old bachelor. Of course I'm dating myself. Nobody else dates me anyway.
Ah, love it. Yeah, I mean, so a lot of the people that listen to the show and participate in this podcast are cynic by nature, we want to question authority and we want to know why people want to do stuff. But I think maybe in my heart of heart that I believe that people are doing this for the right reasons, that they want these access to these things, not because they want to intrude on people's privacy or liberties, but because they actually want to keep us free and they want to keep us safe. And since they don't understand maybe the complex nature of encryption, that they are saying the things that people who also don't understand encryption want to hear, while at the same time scaring the people that, you know, are concerned about liberty and freedom. You know what I mean?
Yes, give up privacy for security and you'll have neither privacy nor security. I think Jefferson or somebody said that.
Franklin, something along the lines of, he who would give up freedom for security deserves neither.
Yeah, I think it's been said by a bunch of people in similar way. Well, you know, That would mean that we need to change the building codes to more Soviet standards, where they have a private elevator so the police can get in.
Oh, I mean, unfortunately, you come down and talk to people in the public, and, probably if it came down to their level, because they think, well, it's somebody else that's going to get spied on, but, you know, they don't understand that. I think we would say that everybody's privacy outweighs the utility of the one in 100 million bad actor that you need to, that you need access to it. And it's just not worth compromising the privacy and security of everybody just for convenience in that one instance. If I was going to give extreme example, we probably ought to be saving this, but, why don't we put a camera in your child's bedroom just because they might be a terrorist?
Yeah.
Yes. It's every security camera should report to the government so that we can be sure that you are secure.
Well,
your cameras are security cameras by government definition, including the ones on this laptop.
Let's, not that I am advocating for mass government surveillance, we should probably calm down the rhetoric of what we're talking about here to become inclusive and have an open discussion.
Sure, though actually my example, that has happened. You guys remember that a few years ago that school gave laptops to every child, but they had hidden security software that allowed them to remotely look at the webcam, and it was like, oh, if it gets stolen, we can see who the thief is, and there wasn't anything to keep whoever had keys to that software to turn on the webcam on that child's computer at any time.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I remember specifically that happened in school districts across the nation where, you know, it was found out that administrators were watching the behavior of troubled children to find out what they were doing outside of school. By no means is that ethical or even within the rights of what a school should be doing. However, the thing with technology, and we look at it across the board, you know, the big argument's always been nuclear power. You know, once we had the technology to harness the atom, we can choose to do good for humanity. We can choose to do bad for humanity. And it's what our society deems necessary to do with it that kind of is the way that it becomes regulated. So I think fundamentally from the aspect of the fact that, Netminer 5150, we all know, and a lot of the people that participate in our community know about how these the hardware we interact with, you know, whether it's a webcam on a laptop, a microphone on a laptop, or a desktop, or any of the Internet of Things devices that are a part of our lives, we understand the threats they represent from people who have malice towards us. I think going out there and saying that, you know, we need to fight for liberty and we need to fight for our rights, well, being fine, I think what we should do is use that energy to inform the general populace who doesn't understand the dangers of using the technology. But at the same time, you don't want them to be scared of the technology so that they kind of shut down and just say, well, you know, it's all or nothing. I'm either all in or I'm all out. So I'm probably just rambling a lot, and I apologize.
No, but I think the whole thing is I was raised as a 50s kid during the 60s, and I think I'm seeing the 50s coming back real fast.
How do you mean?
Well, for instance, did you recall hearing the Linux Journal website was considered a radical site by the government because of its support for encryption and privacy?
Yeah, and beyond that, most people that subscribe to different Linux podcasts as well as visited various Linux websites or other periodicals were also put on that list. Yes, I do remember that.
Yes, well, the thing we're looking at is privacy is becoming un-American.
Okay, McCarthyism. Got it. And that is a very real danger. And that's why while we have a forum and we have a place to stand on, we shouldn't demonize the other side, because that doesn't really sway people to our line of believing. It would change their views, but the only people that would support us would be those with vitriol or people that would have extreme anti-government beliefs. Whereas you want to approach the moderates and the people that are, typically the people that are moderates don't have a strong opinion one way or another. And I know that's kind of generalizing, but I'm not saying that there's, from the viewpoint of privacy and security and liberty, they have a very naive view. And I don't want that to sound insulting, but you know, when you talk to people who say the government can listen in on your microphones, or you can, you know, the government can watch your video camera, or the government's saving all your emails or listening to your phone calls, the majority of people will say, you know, of the people that aren't really concerned with that, they'll either rationalize and saying, well, I don't have anything to hide, which is the same kind of mindset that people use to turn a blind eye to injustice. So the people that have the extreme views that are being kind of put on this list are kind of stuck in that they don't have any widespread support because, well, I'm not one of those people. Whereas if we bring them in by making it inclusive and saying, here's really what's going on, and you know, it's not anything to be, you know, the sky's not falling, but it's something to be concerned about, you know, you kind of get a more kind of a grassroots approach to solving this issue.
Well, the fact that but people love the Patriot Act, but they don't realize that this act has been promulgated before Germany in the 30s.
Right, right. And it's not that you want to paint a rosy view for everybody. You know, you can show people the truth, at least as you understand it, which is going to be different from the truth that I understand. But I think we need to, this is going to sound, again, cliched, but we need to promote skepticism. You know, trust but verify. You know,
well, the problem you have here is the stuff that's been reported even during, I'm a registered Republican, but the stuff that was reported where the government agencies were not even going to the secret courts that were designed to allow them to do their wiretapping or what have you with private authority. Well, leads one to be nervous.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, if you look at just the past probably year, and again, this is, you know, very US-centric viewpoint, but we're having this kind of change in like the whole we're having a whole turnover in our society, and it's kind of a, I'm going to use a fishing analogy here, in that when you're fishing, and there's a period of time in late fall, right before winter, where most bodies of water, at least in my region, go through this turnover period where the water starts to churn because of the temperatures, so that you get this kind of mix and the water stabilizes. And as it does, the fish kind of move into a winter pattern where they're kind of holding low in the lakes. And it's not until the spring when the water start warming up and they spawn that do they start to get active again. And that's kind of what, at least what I'm seeing is here, is that we've gone through this period where, you know, we had a status quo for 8 years. Republicans disliked the Democrats. Democrats disliked the Republicans. You had the kind of mix in the House and the Senate with the executive branch. And then all of a sudden this came, this new kind of approach to the executive office came out of really left field and has thrown everybody for a loop. And a lot of people are uncertain, and that's kind of being played out across the board.
Well, the thing that's happening is the government is being run with the skins off a lot. Some of the stuff that they're reporting, like there was a lady who was an illegal immigrant that under the Obama administration was allowed to report every year to the immigration authorities, and finally got deported because the administration changed. Now we're finding how, what happens if somebody follows the rules, not follows the practices. It's a bit of a white mutiny when you follow exactly what the rules are instead of what everybody usually does.
Well, I think what you have are de facto laws or de facto rules, you know, and then you have the stated rules or stated laws. And what we find is that as society changes, the definitions of those laws change. You know, there are some things that have a metric that we can measure, such as, you know, speed limit is 25 miles an hour. If I'm going 32 miles an hour, I am technically violating the law. And this is, you know, obviously a misdemeanor, and it's not, it's a very black and white example. But, you know, the de facto law is that if you're going 32 miles an hour, you are likely to not get a speeding ticket.
And that's, well, regional. Here, you know, street speeds are pretty strictly enforced, at least of 2 or 3 miles an hour. Now, out on the highway, I would set my speed, you know, counting on a 10 mile an hour grace period. In other words, if the speed limit was 65, I would set the cruise at 75, till I got nailed at 72, and since then I set the cruise 5 miles an hour above the posted speed limit. But here in the cities, yeah, you can get, if it's a 30 mile an hour speed limit, they'll nail you at 31, 32.
Here's another example of effective versus statutory laws. During the time of the 55 mile an hour speed limit, some guys out in California got together across one of the many expressways and decided to set their speedos at 55 mile an hour with, you know, four guys in four lanes. they got popped for obstructing traffic, because 55 mile an hour speed limit on roads that are already overloaded would just cause them to choke, as they tend to do.
Certainly. Well, what do you think? Should we kick this off?
Are we all here?
That's a broad question with this audience, you know.
And truth be told, I haven't been following the feedback as well as I should have been. So I don't know if we have any feedback. But I'd like to think that we want to give the people what they want.
Casting my mind back, I don't recall anything significant, but I might go back and scan through my email in the G+ sessions. If it's G+, I probably haven't seen it. Haven't been keeping up on the social media like I would like.
Yeah, likewise.
I need to step aside for a moment. First, to take care of something, and then I've got a fictional quote that covers a lot of what we were just talking about, if that's still going to be an open topic. But I'll get back to you in a few.
All right. I think, yeah, I'm looking through the feedback, and we've got an announcement from the OSI community about Chick Tech, but that's all I see that's of relevance to the show here. Are you looking at Google Plus there, 50?
Sorry, I was just quickly finishing up my links for my show notes. Give me a minute.
Oh, no problem. I'll go in there now. All right. I will host tonight. I'll start reading through the introduction, and then I'll do the listening feedback about the Chick Tech OSI community announcement, and then I'll go through the Google community, so the G+ community, and kind of read out some of the stuff that's in there, because it looks like there were a couple of discussions that were started up, although did not participate, but it looks like some good stuff. Then I'm certain that we will have a bevy of additional people join and delight us with insight and humor. Any objections?
None here.
Netminer, you still with us?
I think he stepped away.
Yep, and I don't want to do the introduction where I'm calling upon him. So we'll wait until he gets in. Let the record stand. I'm enjoying these potato chips here greatly.
Well, I actually had a free lunch today. I was wanting to check out new barbecue restaurant in town, and but as luck would have it, strangely, they closed at 2 o'clock. They told me the other day that they were having trouble finding help, so they only were open from 11 to 2, and I thought I would just drop in at the end, and I wasn't thinking, being a barbecue restaurant, they don't want a whole bunch of carryover inventory. So there's a sign on the door that says, you know, we're out. I get there probably about 1:45, and I said, oh, man. And the friendly people said, come on in. I said, yeah, came into town just so I could try out the new restaurant. And they said, probably it was leftover somebody was planning to take home. But they said, oh, no, wait a minute. So they said, you know, here's some spare ribs that didn't have enough meat on them to meet our standards, and some sauce and the leftover macaroni and cheese. So I said, somebody probably saved that for themselves to go home with. So I'm was grateful to them for that. And it had, and really, as far as not enough meat on the ribs, had enough to enjoy a late lunch when I got home, and enough left over to have a late dinner after the show.
Wow, that is really cool. Yeah, I know we have a place near our house that the guy used to operate out of his truck, just selling, you know, at a like a trailer, and he was at a gas station. And then he kind of grew because he became so popular that he moved into a restaurant. Well, the strip mall he was in didn't like the fact that, despite being a real authentic barbecue place, that his restaurant was generating smoke in order to make the barbecue. So they kind of kicked him out, and he found a new place. And I can remember the first time I drove down there, and I had my heart set on getting, whatever they had left, only to find out that the restaurant had taken the week off for a family vacation, which, while disappointing to me, was kind of very refreshing to see that somebody, even though they have a successful business, even though it was during the summer, that they had still taken time off so that they could go on a trip together. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that's what we've had is this is a different barbecue place. This guy only has, does business out of a fifth wheel trailer, and he'll go from town to town to town, and he's in our town and maybe about three times a month. And if I catch him, I'll buy some stuff and stock up.
Yeah, I
But
remember a place in that I was in Seattle, and I recall the same thing where they were only open like maybe 2 or 3 hours a day, but there was a line around the block to get the food, and once they sold out of something, they were out.
And I have been enjoying as long as it lasts. I think it's probably too small a market, but about 2 weeks ago, a sushi restaurant opened up, an incredibly huge menu variety of stuff. And if you don't like sushi, they'll do tempura and steaks and stuff, but mainly sushi on the menu.
Yeah, I saw all your posts about that and how your the expected portions far exceeded the presented portions.
Well, the portions are probably about what I got at other restaurants. It was just, like I said, it was getting late where I knew I wasn't going to have a chance to order again if it wasn't enough. So I says more my eyes being bigger than my stomach. But yeah, well, one of the fancy rolls would be enough for any meal. I usually do one of the fancy and one of the similar ones, which has about half as or simpler ones, which has about half as many pieces. So, I did take home on that the other day, and that was certainly more than enough.
I guess I'm just the thought of sushi doesn't really appeal to me. The couple of times that I've had it, it's not been something I've ever found a taste for. But the thought of leftover sushi is possibly worse.
Yeah, and really, I mean, even the takeout, it's not as good as you're right there and you sit down and eat. Especially took me a while, and had to reheat dinner stick in the refrigerator, but I didn't reheat it. Then at first, where I had got home with way too, got home with extra, that didn't last till lunch the next day. But yeah, it would be best consumed right away, but it's not bad.
Yeah, the thing I think I thought when I saw that you post that I thought of my initial thought was about how landlocked you are.
Yeah, and that's I saw that was one somebody posted that on the Facebook says, yeah, or no, I was in there and overheard the conversation at the next table. I guess they were having something other than the sushi, the tempura or whatever, and one of the guys saying, yeah, and I wouldn't think anything about it down on the coast, but I'm wary of having it in the middle of the country. And I don't know, I mean, it used to be we used to never see any kind of seafood, I mean, other than Long John Silver's. And ironically, you probably saw in the post, this restaurant is in the recently closed Long John Silver's building. Even the grocery stores, you had only fish you would see in the grocery stores was fish sticks. And now you can go in there and get salmon and tilapia and, in fact, I've actually made my own sashimi with raw salmon from the grocery store. So, you do what you can. You make do.
Well, now I expect this year when you go out to either the coasts for any of your fests, That's going to be your first stop.
Yeah, actually, that's not a bad idea, because I will be in Washington, so they should be a little closer. Maybe do a little comparison, see if that opens my eyes, because, you know, really my only experience with it is it was been the big city of Wichita, and there's quotes around that for anybody who's listening, and this restaurant, price-wise, portion-wise, quality-wise, pretty much stands up to the two or three restaurants that I've tried in the big city.
Well, good deal. I'm glad that you found that. And anything you can do to support a local business. Well, I think I'm going to kick this off because we need to give the people what they want. And what the people want, I'm assuming, is Linux.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast, live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Lionridge, he's a bloody drunk.
If you don't like the gas, you can get up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that are Lincoln bad.
G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.